Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. My guest today is Sarah Kane Gutowski. Sarah Kane Gutowski is the author of Fabulous Beast, winner of the 14th Annual National Indies Excellence Award for Poetry and a 2019 Forward Indies finalist. With interdisciplinary artist Meredith Starr, she is co-creator of Every Second Feels Like Theft, a conversation in cyanotopes and poetry, and It's All Too Much, a limited edition audio project. Her poems have appeared in the Gettysburg Review, the Threepenny Review, Painted Bride Quarterly, and the Southern Review, and her criticism has been published by Colorado Review, Calyx, and New York Journal of Books. Her new collection is a book-length narrative and poems titled The Familiar, which explores female midlife existential crisis through two characters, the ordinary self and the extraordinary self, who send a single household into chaos as they vacillate between the siren call of ambition, the necessity of the workplace, and responsibility to love and family. Welcome, Sarah, and hell yes.
Thank you so much for having me here, Lindsay. I'm so excited. I am such a fan of the podcast.
Oh my God, I love hearing that. And what a book to talk about on this podcast. I feel like we can end the podcast after this because this is sort of getting at
No, you can't, because it's like a solace for me. Like I look forward to the episodes, and yeah, so please don't.
Okay,
I would
fine.
Feel so sad.
I absolutely love this. I tore through it. As I mentioned earlier, I like kind of went into like student state where I was just like furiously taking notes and asking questions to the universe about it. And so excited to talk to you. But first, you have to read to us.
Thank you. Okay. So as you said, the book focuses on two main characters, the ordinary self and the extraordinary self. And it begins with the ordinary self waking up a little disoriented, and she doesn't quite remember what happened, like a fairy tale. A great damage. My ordinary self wakes but can't remember when she fell asleep in this room. The sheets, slick with damp, feel unfamiliar. Grit rims her eyelids, and even the mattress feels foreign, like something loaned from memory's recesses. We haven't seen her for years. She hasn't been allowed to visit. Now she's here, suddenly, as if summoned by a spell and welcomed, coaxed and flattered by our pleas. Desperation's humidity rises from the bed. Daylight, dishwashers, doctor's offices. My ordinary self must become reacquainted with ordinary living. She wanders the rooms. Her feet sink, make light depressions in the carpet and brief dark splotches on the hardwood. She thinks about making an appointment for an oil change. She consults the kitchen's calendar, but its coated loops of pen and crossouts confuse, refuse to clarify. There's too much to undo here, she thinks. A great damage has been done. Panic beads her skin. As if on cue from our bedroom shadows, the clock shrieks an alarm. They sing her praises. In something of a paradox, my ordinary self is rather extraordinary. My ordinary self has follow through. Not all of the natural world, or the unnatural, has this persistence, the dogged will to see a thing done to its very damn end. That's why she's so good at laundry. She remembers how important it is to keep the clothes from pressing too far into one another, creating canyons of wrinkles. She avoids embarrassing piles of socks and thongs and linens from forming new terrain on the furniture. She hangs when delicates need drying, folds when the cycle is finished. She itemizes by type, material, color, and care. These days, no one ever goes without matching socks, unless by choice. My ordinary self is tireless, albeit weary of fitted sheets and their perfect, stubborn, imperfect corners. In the basement laundry, crickets keep her company. They sing her praises in the dark, though no one listens. Backseat scores. It's not like we drew up charges and nailed them to the door. One morning, my ordinary self appeared, much older, of course, than we'd seen her last, yet still her essential ordinary self, so dependable, so not extraordinary. But the house couldn't hold us all. Not enough hot water, only so much space on the family couch. My extraordinary self took it badly, jumped, fully clothed, into denial. She made claims about promises, sacrifice, and betrayal. Quite frankly, it was embarrassing. My ordinary self moved around her in a tidy silence, sweeping the broken dishes off the floor. Then my extraordinary self changed tactics. She took the children to a water park, a carnival, and the arcade. Next, she bought two sets of crotchless panties and took my husband on long, indulgent car rides. She cooked elaborate meals. And yet, my dog liked my ordinary self more. She never forgot to feed him. And the children ran to her with their cuts and sores. Even my husband preferred my ordinary self's predictable morning sex to roadside backseat scores. My extraordinary self had to admit defeat. My ordinary self would stay and she would leave. That last night, while the family watched the Avengers, she curled fetal on the carpet and wept noisily at our feet. With every disappointment. Occasionally, and always on the sly, my extraordinary self visits the children. My eldest daughter, easily influenced, gives her a key, humors her crazy fantasies about taking a trip, flying to Italy, walking the bridges of Venice before they become home to Coral, another city besieged by man and water. They are co-conspirators, the globe of my daughter's open, hopeful face, antipodal to my extraordinary self's lost faith. My daughter imagines she will somehow leave too, a tiny travel companion beside her adventurer mother, until it becomes apparent that my extraordinary self never intends to take her. You always do this, my daughter sobs. You make promises and then you break them. For once, my extraordinary self is satisfied. This is a gift, she tells my daughter. Be less like me. With every disappointment, grow certain of what you won't become. So eventually the extraordinary self convinces the husband character to go on the trip to Italy and they abandon the family. And this takes place in the airport. My heart, not hers, and not hers either. If not for Buffalo Wild Wings and their extra large beers, my husband might have divorced my extraordinary self right at the airport. A man traveling with the least wise version of his wife needs a drink or two or three, because she will test all of his versions. Perhaps this is where we acknowledge this conceit is not unique, nay, not extraordinary. We all house within our skin and brains another self or two, whole persons devoted to one aspect of 21st century life with particular, not entirely healthy focus. Because I fought to maintain my own shit show of personalities, I'm not sure which version of my husband sat with that version of myself at the airport bar, eating fried whatever. All I know is that on the plane, afterward, separated from him by rows and crammed between two baby boomers who didn't want to share their vacant center seat, my heart burned. Hard indigestion, sure, but with a moment of clarity. It was my heart, not hers, and not hers either. In the scratched chairback TV screen, I saw my reflection, its schism more raw and obvious than ever. Why had I brought us here? Outside, the black tarmac winked its lights as the jet roared. Seatbelt signs saying their warnings. Trailing tissue with her shoe, my extraordinary self returned crying from the bathroom. The stewards tried to soothe her with another drink, a different seat. Several rows behind, my husband settled with relief, grateful for this brief respite from all of me. And then we took off.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And for everyone listening, they're all like that. And, you know, it follows this narrative, even as it's examining these, like these universal things, you know, this compartmentalization that we're all sort of going through. There's a narrative that, you know, that we're following, that, you know, that we're following these characters. We're learning more about them. But I don't know. I was so, first of all, I kind of wanted to bring up your general energy. Because when you contacted me to be on the podcast, I don't know, like you're just, your energy was so like, I am a badass and I have the chops and like, you need to read this. And I don't know what it was. I could go back and read your email to our listeners, but it was more like, I don't know. There was just, I want to talk to you about how you've cultivated that energy, which like has given you this like, ability to market your book so effectively. When you sent me the book, you know, you printed your own, I think you printed your own copy.
Yeah.
Your own bound copy. Cause it's not, it's when is the exact release date?
The release date was like 2 days ago, really. I know. And it's because they, I mean, it got moved around a lot, but Texas Review Press, they're an amazing press, but they are a small publisher and they don't print ARCs. So I was like, you know, when I was pitching reviewers or podcasts or whatever, just trying to, because they also don't have a marketing department, really. They have like three different like full-time staff members who are really doing everything and then some interns. So I've been trying to do as much as a bit. Much of that job I could as myself from I was trying to do as much of it as I could myself. And I mean, it does take a certain belief in your book to put yourself out there like that. And I think because I'm making fun of myself through the whole book, like it was a lot easier to do that. Like you have to read this thing. I'm just really mean to myself. But it also just, I think because I've been having conversations with other women who are my peers, like the same age, anywhere between like 40 and 50, but maybe even at like going 35 to 55, you know, just in it, like somewhere from like Gen X to elder millennial. It's just, everybody's kind of having this moment where they're like, this is not what I was promised. And also I need to be resourceful and I need to be like, and just suck it up because, okay, so I didn't get what I was promised. But, so part of that has helped with like the marketing part of it is that like, I kind of believe that reading about your own experience, because I've taken that from other authors, like it's so valuable. So, you know, is this book like the most important issue right now? No, but I know it's going to speak to like some very specific people out there.
And, you know, I think like that argument of like, well, it's, you know, it's not about like the migrant crisis. It's not about Gaza. So we shouldn't, I think like being able to feel seen like that by something like this allows you to feel stronger for those other things, but that's a whole other conversation. But I just, I was so taken by your ability to, because that's, I'm going to finish a sentence, your ability to market yourself, because that is a skill that I think writers don't understand that it's okay for us to have. And often we should have it. And it's okay to talk about our work as if it's important and that it matters and that someone's going to like it. And I felt like that came from your, what spoke to me from that was that came from your like experience of just being a writer for as, you know, however long you've been a writer, and like facing yourself again and again and again, which being a writer forces you to do as you're trying to get these things out there, getting people to read them, getting people to connect with them, getting things onto the page. I felt like it was all sort of wrapped up in the way that you came to me about this book. And then when you mailed it to me, there was like all this cute little swag that you did yourself.
Completely
And
ridiculous.
no, I just thought, oh my God, like I almost felt like I had some growing up to do, because I was like, this is exactly the kind of way that we should be talking about our work. And we should be, you know, like not that people should be, you know, everyone should be doing that or whatever, but that it's okay to accept that you can talk about your book as a commodity, as something you want people to experience, and that you understand how to market it. I just felt so impressed by that, because that's something that I think I didn't understand I needed to be good at, or that I needed to know about, or that it was it, like there's some part of me that's like, you can't talk about your book in a positive way. Like people are going to think you're an asshole, you know? And but it's not true at all. Actually,
No.
it really helps, you know? Like it made me feel like I was in good hands from the get-go.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, like that. And you should be talking about Hot Springs Drive because it's amazing.
Thank
It's
you.
so beautiful. The prose is really
Thank
gorgeous.
you.
And I love the structure. Its episodic structure, I think, is, I think also because I've been listening to the podcast for quite a while, like I know a little bit about how you wrote it. So
Yep.
it felt to me like completely manageable and of that time too, which
Yes.
s felt so appropriate for the content of the book too, because these are mothers and they are, stuck in the drudgery of the everyday. And so, I mean, if they were going to be writing books, this is how they would do it in their car, 15 minutes at a
Yes.
time, getting out like the 500 words at a time or just whatever they could. So I feel like the book is really special for that. And so, yeah, hell yeah, you should be singing its praises and
I'll try. Would you say Jackie is the extraordinary self turned toxic
yes.
and Teresa's the ordinary self?
Yes, 100%.
And who's the inevitable self? I love that we get the
I
inevitable self
know.
at the end. It's such a delight. Well, I mean, let's talk about the origin of this book, because I feel like, you know, you mentioned that it's you making fun of yourself and you kind of being mean to yourself, but that is not easy to do. And, you know, I've read a couple times or heard somewhere that that this phase of a woman's life is like a second adolescence or a second puberty, right? Like, and you're sort of like re-getting to know yourself as your body's changing in all these ways, which starts probably in your 30s and ends, you know, it can start in your 30s and end in your 50s,
Does it end? I
or it doesn't end, right?
know.
And you know, I feel like especially as someone who's trying to make something and trying to communicate with art, like you are, and you're a parent, right? There become these selves.
Yeah.
And like I find myself compartmentalizing. I don't want to show my kids my feral self because they don't have the ability to understand it yet.
Yeah.
You know, it just might seem like, is mom like losing it? You know, like what's mom doing? You know, like, or, you know, like I almost don't want them to think about me at all. You know, I don't know
Right.
what got you to think about yourselves in this way?
Well, I guess it was around like 2018 because it was pre-pandemic, and I was having, I suppose, like the beginning of my own little midlife crisis, where I had reached a point in my career. Things were happening where I teach at a community college, and things were happening. It was the direction of the college was not what I had signed up for when I first began teaching, which is going to happen. But I mean, I had applied for sabbatical like four times or something and been denied. And it was part of a process where, like, it used to be that like every 7 years you could apply for sabbatical and you would be able to take a semester to work on a project. And it's like the thing that is, it's like the carrot that is kind of dangled after you go through the hoops of tenure and promotion. And it's like, okay, so now that you've gone through those things, we want you to continue doing a good job. So every 7 years, you'll get to take a break and work on the things that matter to you, because otherwise, like, they don't really care about your publications and they don't really care about your art that you're making. And I mean, that's just I teach at a community college. We are about teaching, you know, and teaching the students. But that part of art making, like, it took me a while to adopt the title because it is rather pretentious, but like, I see myself as a teaching artist. And it's like, the way that I'm a good, effective teacher is to talk about the way I make my own art and then convey that to a younger student who then is going to say, oh, okay, this is the way I might do it too. You know, these are some of the tools I might have. And like, I think there's something of value in that. But like, I wasn't getting time to write. I was burned out on committee work and teaching itself, you know, because I mean, as much as I like my students, like, you need a break from the teaching in order to continue to like your students. So I told all of the committees I was on that I was stepping off them. And I said, I haven't been given the time to write, so I'm going to take the time to write. And then I was like, okay, so what am I writing? And I started, I mean, also at that time, I was like looking around at my house, and, you know, we had lived there for maybe like 10 years at that point. And so it was beginning to show like wear and tear, and we have three kids in this very small Cape, and we had two dogs at the time. Now we have three, and it was just complete chaos. And I was like, what the hell have I done? So I've been like so focused on my teaching career that like, it felt like the house was falling down around us. Like, there was just clutter everywhere. I couldn't get out from under it. And I didn't necessarily have like the success that I wanted. Like, I'd been trying to get my first book published for years. It was like rejected, I think 144 times or something, through a contest model. So I also spent, this is such a privilege, like, first world problem, I spent so much money on contest fees, just trying to get it like seen. And so it was basically like, fuck you to the writing world, fuck you to the academic world. And I'm going to sit and like, I'm just going to actually enjoy writing for a while. But then I was like really focused on that. Like, okay, so all of my efforts to become this like teaching artist or professor who is, you know, worth something, like, they all ended up being like crap as far as I was concerned, you know. And that's the extraordinary self. It's like, oh, good. Look at where all that ambition got you. It got you freaking nowhere.
Right.
Yeah.
And so how did you start thinking of her as the extraordinary self?
It's mostly like the extraordinary self that you want to be, like the one who, like, you grew up thinking like, I'm going to do awesome things, right? Like, you have all these dreams, like, I'm going to be this or I'm going to be that. And sometimes like, you reshape those because you realize like, you're not math and science oriented. So there's no way you're going to be an astronaut. my body doesn't do that. I'm not going to be a dancer. There are certain things that you realize about yourself, but then there are those parts that you don't give up. Your ambition, your dreams, and you're like, you haven't hit them. And that's the extraordinary self for me, like that part of me. And she keeps popping up. I mean, right now I'm like doing a little mini, as much as a poet can do a book tour, I'm doing a book tour. And it's, you know, like, I was in Virginia. I live in New York, and I was in Virginia, and I was there for like this art opening of an exhibit that some of my poems are in. And I completely forgot to tell my husband, remind my daughter about a birthday party she had been invited to. And that poor little thing, like, she was getting a text from her friend later on that was like, are you still coming? And I was like, and then she's texting me, and I'm like, oh my God. Like, I felt like such a shit. That's my extraordinary self. Like, that's where she got us. Like, she's so interested in the career and the publishing and the having a poem in an art exhibit that she's like forgotten about the kid's birthday party.
I relate to that so much because I'm just coming out of the phase that you're probably in right now, where you are constantly thinking about yourself and your art and how people are receiving it and if you're doing enough and and like looking around and like thinking like, well, why don't I have that? Or, you know, and so like there was like an intense 3 month period where I was like, you know, obsessed with the numbers and obsessed with every, you know, like, and then because those things are never satisfactory, or like the way my brain works, I don't allow them to be satisfactory except for in very brief moments. It was affecting then how I'm looking at everything else in my life. And, you know, you're looking, we've been in my house for 11 years. The paint is peeling. We've had it painted. It's peeling again. You know, like there's just like chips in the wall. Like there's handprints everywhere, you know, like, and you start to pile that failure on as well. And so it's like, well, I wasn't as successful with my book as I thought I was going to be. So huge failure. What an idiot.
No.
What am I doing? Why can't I appreciate these beautiful children as much as I should? And, you know, like, it's a constant, and I'm just coming out of it. Finally, I'm just coming out of that like self-obsession, thankfully. and that like mind warping, you know, and kind of able to sort of be back in the moment, but it really does feel like there's this other self. And I guess it's my extraordinary self who just like shoves everyone else out of the way. And I can feel myself fighting that, you know, like constantly struggling against that. I don't think that the extraordinary self has to be all toxic, right? Like I do think like those are the things, like I did ask, I had a question. Let me go back to my fugue state questions. The question I had was, is the extraordinary self youth or not youth, but the sort of vigor and verve that youth takes for granted? And is middle age a welcoming back of that stuff? The way children aren't aware of the fact that they will one day want to attract a lover so they can just play in the dirt and be loud and pick their nose openly. Is the extraordinary self that sort of freedom, which can't exist within the context of responsibility, or can it?
I know. Well, I guess that's what I'm still trying. Yes, I think the answer is yes. By the time we get to the end of the book and the inevitable self, it's like the extraordinary self has to be there. And that's also, I mean, you know, they attempt to off the extraordinary self in the book.
Yeah. But the extraordinary self is like, okay, yeah, this is, we should do this.
Yeah. This is right. Like nothing else is working. So I guess, and like there, she's a failure at that too. But like, I think that's the thing, is that like, that also what was happening for me was that as I was writing the poems too, I was writing the poems, which is part of my ambition, part of my calling that is separate from like the calling of having children or the calling of like wanting to have a partnership that is satisfying and, you know, a life with my husband. And like so I was realizing, you know, I was trying to focus more on the house and like, just be like, you know, forget it, forget publishing, forget all this stuff. And then my book was picked up by a publisher. My first book was picked up and I was like, of course, like I was over the moon, you know, excited. And then at the same time, like when I was like focusing on myself, I was like, actually, I'm going to apply for Breadloaf Sicily, which I don't think they're running anymore, but it was amazing. And again, like I took my husband and we had to leave the kids for like a week to go do that. It was totally
I don't know if that came through, but she said it was totally worth it.
I love them so much, but yes. It was totally worth it. Yeah.
You know what? What is that guilt about? Because I want, there's like, I guess the extraordinary self part of me, or maybe even the inevitable self part of me, wants my kids to look back and see that their mother was working and creating, and that people were, you know, like connecting, you know, like I want them to have that. I want them to see that. But anytime I'm invited to go do something somewhere else, you know, I have to travel and go somewhere, I feel this intense, like, you know, am I leaving them? Am I abandoning them? And, you know, like, what is that? Why can't we just go do our jobs? You know?
I know. And it's partly historical, you know, and it's partly like the way that history has decided our roles as mothers, but it's also part, I think, just biology too, because there is a certain, I mean, I'm also saying this is in a very general way, you know, but like my husband and I, we've noticed, you know, there are just points where like they just want mom, you know, and like you're not gonna, you know, I mean, there are parts too where they really want dad, but like for the most part, like especially when they're very, very little,
Yeah.
They really want mom. And so it just makes it really difficult to like turn off that, you know, switch and then shift to work, which I think was easier for men. I think like biologically, like you, a baby comes out of you, it wants to hang out with you.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it doesn't necessarily want to go to the dad right away.
Yeah.
So like the dads historically have had a much easier time like going away for hours at a time to support the family, you know? And then if a woman wants to do that, it takes some adjustment on everybody's part, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's still, you know, like, why is she able to, you know, like there's still like this, huh? You know, like, I don't know, societal, like, okay.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I was listening to the Isabel Kaplan episode, which it was a while ago, but like, I kind of listened to him out of order, and she writes a completely different novel than, my book, you know, like, and, but it is, I think we're talking about a slightly different myth of female empowerment. Because with the mother character in her book and the daughter character, you know, this thing happens to the daughter, and the mother is like, well, you know, yes, you can like stand up for yourself. Like, this involves like the Me Too movement, you know, like saying, like, yes, you can defend yourself. And, but like, what's the cost going to be? And it's like this real, very real thing. And she's in the podcast, she was speaking about like, this is what success feels like. Why doesn't it feel better? And that's what that character is also feeling in that moment. And like, I think we were told growing up that like we could have everything that we wanted, you know? And as like, that was something that second wave feminism did for us. There was a bit of a disservice. I mean, well-meaning, but like, no, we can't do it all. We can't, like, there's biology that's against us. There's society that's still against us. There are our own selves that are against us. Like, yes, our own psychology that's against us. Like, it's not as simple as saying, here's the opportunity. Right. Because then there's also this part of it where if you don't take that opportunity, then you're ungrateful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or you squandered it, you know, and if you're not successful, you've squandered the opportunity that was given to you. And I think that's like, it's like a thread or a muscle like that's running through every one of us from, you know, Gen X to the millennials, you know.
Yeah, I think it's like, yeah, sure, you can have it all. Good luck with that. You know, like there's not, you know, like there's not like, oh, and also here's your village, right? Like it's, you know, I've said this on the pod before, but one of my old bosses, she was the owner of our company, and I asked her to take some time off if I could go write, you know, some unpaid time off from work. Like, I think I asked her for 6 weeks, maybe four. And she agreed. And she said, you know, I'm going to say yes to this. And it's because women can have it all, but not at the same time. And I was like, oh, she had four kids.
So she knew.
She knew. Yeah. And so I've thought about that every, almost, you know, every day since then, because she's, in a way it makes it, like more palatable, right? Like it's like, okay, well, I'm in like the deep baby phase, right? Okay. Now I'm out of that. So I can be more in like the work phase. Well, you know, fuck writing. So now I'm back in the home phase, you know?
Like, yeah.
It makes sense that we've, this group of people that you're talking about, the, you know, the elder millennials to Gen X, have fractured into these selves. And that was another question I was going to ask you. You did answer it, after I had the question, and you did read that poem, in the opening, was if it's a specifically feminine type of compartmentalization, mm-hmm. To, you know, to fracture into the ordinary and the extraordinary and then the inevitable. And, you know, but you do touch on the fact that yes, men also do this, but I would like to hear if you feel like there's a difference in the way that they compartmentalize, in the way that they fracture.
I think so. I mean, it's been interesting because I think that my husband and I have been experiencing kind of like midlife crises around the same time, which is not good for our kids and households.
How's it manifesting? Are you guys like, are you like on a Harley? My dad got a Harley.
Oh, well, no, it's like, it's, well, I don't know. My husband has always been like really into like different projects. Like he gets kind of like fixated on he for a while it was like BMX bikes. And that so actually like I think that was the bulk of it. Right now he's probably coming out of it, but like he was obsessed with recreating like BMX bikes from his childhood.
Yes.
And so he's buying parts. There are all these like discussion forums on Facebook and things like that. And so he was part of them and he was like buying and selling parts and like making these bikes and letting kids in the neighborhood ride them. And like it felt like this attempt to like kind of get back the things that he,
Yeah.
had to let go from his childhood. Now he's like, there are only apparently there are only so many bikes you can build. And I think it was somewhere around 30. He was like, now I'm going to switch too. And he's like working on guitars and stuff. And he likes building
So he's
guitars.
like a gear guy. He likes the gear
Yeah.
stuff. Okay.
He's a gear guy. And so that's kind of the way it has manifest for him. I mean, yeah, so I felt like I needed to acknowledge in the book that like while this is going on with like the narrator and her multiple selves, like there's stuff going on with the husband too.
Yeah.
But I couldn't necessarily like write that large because I'm not living that,
Yeah.
it's not my experience to write. So I mean, like too, this is very much like a class kind of oriented book too. Like, someone who is our age right now, but had a very different class experience. Like, I can't speak to that, like, I think it transcends like maybe race and ethnicity insofar as that, like, I know that when I was in like kindergarten in my classes, like, with a teacher surrounded by other kids, and there were a lot of kids of color in my classes because I grew up in the DC area. And so just like you ended up having like, some students who were like multiple ethnicities because they all like were coming from all over. And so I know that like they were told like you can do anything, just like I was told I can do anything. But I mean, maybe when they went home, the story was very different because of like their cultural and ethical background or ethnic backgrounds. And so maybe that was different. But like I feel very much like it's not like I want to apologize for it, but it's just like this is definitely like middle-aged white lady book think of like the and at like a comfortable economic class. I mean, we live on
Yeah.
Long Island, which is one of the most expensive areas to live in the country, along with like LA, Chicago, DC. Like they're expensive areas. So while my husband and I both have good jobs, it's not like we're like rolling in dough.
Yeah.
And we're struggling, like I don't know if we can put all three kids through college. We're gonna see.
Maybe one of them wants to be like a hairstylist or a plumber or something,
I
like
know,
trade
I
school.
know. Trade school would be amazing,
Right?
like but yeah, so it's a book for people who were like, I think, feel the weight of a responsibility to something that they were told
Yeah.
in their youth.
Yeah, there should be a second part of that statement, right? Like you can do anything, you can be anything. It's going to be hard,
Yeah. Yes.
And I feel like, I can remember people, adults in my life as a child being like, yeah, well, life is hard, get over it, but it doesn't sink in, like it doesn't sink in the same way as like watching your parent come home from work and just like sink into the floor,
Yeah.
you mentioned that it's weird like your children watching you go through these midlife crises might be like strange for them. What do you think the experience is for them watching this?
Weird and traumatic, most likely. I mean, am I just creating new, people for therapy? Like their future
No.
patients? Like there, I mean, part of that is true. We laugh, but like the pandemic was not helpful to
Right.
any of our mental states, especially in my household. And so that I think in some ways, like I mean, I guess I can't answer that totally.
Yeah.
I can see that like my daughters. I have almost 19 year old, and I have an almost 11 year old. They're both going to be 19 and 11 in March. And then I have a 15 year old son. And so, like, both of my daughters, I think, are seeing, like, I think my eldest has seen me struggle sometimes with, like, being my own person and having a job and having kids. And she has said at times, she's like, no, I don't want children. And I wonder how much I'm responsible for that feeling because she has watched the struggle or witnessed it. And then, but then also sometimes, like, she gets baby crazy when she sees a baby in a restaurant. So who knows?
Yeah.
But, you know, and then my youngest, like, she's really young, and in some ways, like, the 11-year-olds were really, that their age group was really resilient during the pandemic. And I
My
felt
son is
like
11.
they, okay, yeah,
Yeah.
I watched them, like, it felt like they did super well through the pandemic. But then, yeah, so I don't know yet. I know,
Yeah.
you know, like, I hope that whatever I'm doing doesn't dissuade them from doing the things that they want,
Yeah.
to pursue,
Yeah.
you know. But I guess, like, if they were to ask me, you know, I would say, well, yeah, so here are the things you got to think about,
Yeah.
you know.
Right. And then you got to wonder, are they going to listen? You know, like, are they
I
going to hear
know.
it coming from me, their mother, right?
And they might not, you
They might
know.
not. And, you know, there's so many things I can think back on when my mom was leveling with me. And I think back on them now and I'm like, oh my God, she was leveling with me. You know, like, oh, I'm so grateful for that. You know, like she was just like taking me by the shoulders and being like, listen, kid, you know. It's funny that your daughter says that she doesn't want kids. My 5-year-old daughter has said that since she was 3. Like,
Oh my
I'm not having
gosh.
kids. No, never, never having kids, never. And I thought the same thing. Oh my God, she's seen like the chaos of our lives and she's seen me maybe not handle it as well as I could. Or she's, you know, like I try to be very even with, you know, with them, but maybe I'm failing and she's seeing that and it looks terrible to her and she's miserable and our house is sad. But recently she's been like, I'm never having kids, but mom, can you have 20 more kids? Because I want more kids in our house. And so I'm like, oh, it has nothing to do with our family. She wants more chaos. If anything, she wants,
No.
you know,
Well,
like,
the last one is always the chaos monster.
oh, she is feral. She is absolutely
Yes.
feral. She just whirls through the
And
house.
they're so smart because they're picking
Yes.
up everything from everybody else, you know?
Yes.
Like, I mean, not like, oh, my kid's so smart and wonderful, but, like, this is, like, scary how much they pick up and absorb. Like, it's kind of terrifying.
For her, I feel like she picks it up and she's so little that sometimes she doesn't understand when things are sarcasm or things are not actually, you know, like maybe someone's tone of voice makes it sound like it's a big deal, but it's actually not a big deal at all. So I feel like she carries these little like anxieties around and sometimes she'll be like, Mom, you know, like and ask me a question like very quietly behind her hand. And I realize, oh, you're so capable. You know, she's been walking up and down the stairs by herself since she was 18 months old. My boys were never like that. And she seems so capable, but she's, you know, she still doesn't have the chops and the life experience to understand things. I don't know. You know, I feel like we try not to do the things our parents did to us and then we do other things instead. You
I
know?
mean, that's exactly it. You know, you think, like, I think you try to do the opposite of whatever, you know, didn't work out for your family growing up. And then sometimes you find out, like, you're doing the exact thing. Like, and that's disappointing and depressing, but at least you acknowledge it, you know?
Exactly.
Like, 'cause I do think, I mean, we've been talking about, you know, like, with mental health issues, and they say, like, well, does, like, anxiety and depression run in your family? And I'm like, well, like, possibly. Like, I think, like, I can see, you know, aspects of that in, like, maybe my parents, but, like, their generation never went to therapy. Like, they never sought mental health experts. And then their grandparents beyond, like, it's like, I remember my, or their parents beyond, like, I can remember my grandparents and think, like, oh, like, maybe I get this from
Yeah.
that person. But, like, you don't know, because, like, they were just getting through
Totally.
World War II. They didn't care.
You know, they had a like a gin and tonic, and that, you know, that's what they did. And they
Right.
had another one and another one. You know, and I think about like when I was a kid, the anxiety that I felt, it was kind of like, you got to, you know, get over it, like snap out of it, get it together. And that's just the tools that that generation had to deal with what looked like maybe behavioral problems or, you know, just like being annoying. And I'm so happy to see that in my children's generation, not only at home, but like at school, when there's behavioral issues in the classroom, they look at it in a much different way. You know, like what, how can we support this kid who's learning the tools to deal with whatever, anxiety, disappointment, whatever it is. You know, so we are getting better in those ways. And I try to treat those things at home differently than they were treated in my home growing up. No shade to my parents. They were doing what they thought was best. But you know, like it's just different. It's just it's wild how we've evolved.
I know. And I mean, we might also like, I since the pandemic, I've been thinking so much about like the resilience question. And like, there is a point too where like, if we honor and respect like every tiny little feeling, then it becomes too much, right?
Right.
Like, and then you can't, because there is like, you can't function in the world if you're honoring and protecting like every little feeling that you have.
Yes.
Like, the world will eat you up.
Yes.
So how do you broker like the right balance between saying, okay, your feelings are genuine and you should have them, but also you got to move on. You know, like, we can't cry
Yes.
over tying our shoes.
Or we
It's
can, but we
just not
still have
going
to
to
tie
work.
our shoes.
Right.
Okay. Like,
Yes. Like, go ahead and have the cry, but get the shoes tied now and get in the car.
I heard a psychologist talking about how mental illness isn't that you have emotions, right? Emotions are healthy. So if you're having you know, like you're angry about something, that's not mental illness. You should be having appropriate emotions. Mental illness is when you are not having appropriate emotions. So something that should scare you doesn't scare you. Something that you know, should make you feel sad, you know, makes you feel like panicky instead, or something like that. Mental illness is not emotions. And I think a trend has been to sort of think about emotions as like, oh no, you know, like everyone should be in this steady state of contentedness at all times, or else something's wrong. And that's actually not true, right? And so, like, yeah, helping your kids be understand like you're going to be disappointed and bored and mad and feel shitty in your life. That's just life. And then the next thing will come along, you know? And speaking of the next thing coming along, I want to bring up the inevitable self, which was such a delight to get to in this book. I want to hear about how she came about for you as you were writing. Did she always exist? Did she pop up as
No.
you were getting there? Okay, tell me.
Yeah, she popped up because so the center part of the, or not center, but the kind of the middle of the book, where the extraordinary self and the ordinary self make a pact to off the extraordinary self, and they keep trying all these different ways to murder her. And I wrote like more of those poems than any other section of the book, and I was like, where the hell is this going? I don't. I was like, and also she wasn't dying, and I was, and like I was getting like a kick out of that, like, oh, there she is again, she's still here. But then I was like, well, this has to get to a point, like something has to happen. And I was like, oh, like the older self comes in and she's like, what's wrong with you two? Like, smacks him around a little bit and like gets the house in back in order a little bit.
I love her, and she reminds me of that Mary Ruffel. Is it called On Menopause, or After Menopause, something like that, where she's completely past all the anxieties that she had as a younger woman, and is able to just completely just love existing in the moment, and you know, doesn't give a shit about the male gaze, doesn't give a shit about the female gaze. You know, and like those things dropped away, and the essence of what is joyful for her in life has sort of swelled for her. And that's how I thought of the inevitable self, was just like, you know, yeah, you guys are gonna like struggle with this, and that makes sense, but eventually this is what it's gonna be. You're gonna be this older woman, you know, like, and what's important is important, and everything else isn't.
I mean, that was, I think too, I don't know. Can I ask you, what did you think about the tone of the end of the book?
What a good question. Well, I love anything that doesn't tie anything up for me.
Okay. Because it certainly does not.
No. And so because I want to keep thinking about these things. I don't want, like, the end of the book isn't the end for me,
Okay.
especially with something like this. That's like my
Yeah.
favorite kind of book. So like, I don't know. I was gonna read you to you, but it's the final paragraph. Sometimes, she sighs, we don't learn a goddamn thing. Most of us are flat chalk slates washed clean by time, dust, and then the darkness. In the end, no lesson remains. Come on. That is so good.
Well, I felt like also it's so depressing. That's why I was asking you, because I was like, oh God, what did I just do? But I was also like, no, that's the end.
That's the end. And
That's the
I
end.
wasn't so much depressed by it as just like it's a reiteration of like what remains, right? Like what and that answer might be different for everyone reading it. Like
Okay.
we can learn these things. We certainly learned things in puberty. We certainly learned them as we became young women. And then sometimes those things have to be relearned. Sometimes they don't make sense anymore, and we have to learn a new thing. And it's like, yeah, that makes so much sense to me,
Okay.
And I just want to keep thinking about it. I just, like that's, I get the feeling, I totally understand the feeling of like, oh shit, I'm a downer. Like I didn't mean to be that, like
Oops,
I'm a
sorry.
delight. I'm actually a nice person, okay? Goodreads reviewers. But I don't know. Darkness is meaningful to me. It's important, I think, especially as women, for us to talk about that,
Yeah.
and especially in aging. And there's a lot of light here too. So no, I wasn't. I don't know. And I'm sure that's different for every reader, which is the delight of a book like this, because they're going
Thank
to
you.
find themselves in lots of different ways,
I hope so.
But it's published by the University of Texas Press,
Or
right?
it's not University of Texas, it's Texas Review Press. It's the
Texas.
University Press of Sam Houston University. Oh,
Okay,
God.
so I
They
totally messed
changed
that
their
up.
name. It was Texas
Oh
Review Press, and then they changed the
yeah,
name to
TRP.
like
Yep.
TRP, the University Press of SHSU, which is Sam Houston State University,
Awesome.
which is a mouthful.
What was it
But
like getting this to them, getting them to take it? What was that like?
well, they published my first book, which is a collection of poems that also deals with motherhood and is also weird. It examines motherhood and voice and autonomy through the lens of like fable, fairy tale, and myth. And it was runner up for their XJ Kennedy Prize, and they published the runner up. So that's how I ended up getting published. And so grateful to them for that. And then I was at, I think it was AWP 2020. So the book came out in 2019. And by that point, I knew I had this book. I wanted to sit with it a while and edit the poems and figure out like the narrative and what needed to be cut and what could stay. But I asked my editor, I was like, would you look at it? And he's like, yes, because they don't have a clause about like, the right of first refusal in their contract. And I didn't know if like I needed to keep applying in the contest model, which is really a terrible model. I mean, I know that everybody kind of all these small presses need to do it. We have lost all of our wealthy benefactors who
Yeah.
supported us in the arts. So they looked at it, and they actually looked at two manuscripts, because I have this other manuscript that is an art book with Meredith Starr. So it's cyanotypes, these beautiful dark blue pieces of photographic art, and they're combined with poems, and we created it during the pandemic. It was like a kind of call and response. I'd send her a poem, she'd make a cyanotype, or she'd send me an image, and then I would make a poem. And I don't know if like the poems weren't strong enough, or if they were just like, this will cost way too much to publish, but they said no thank you on that one. But then they accepted the second. They accepted the familiars.
And is that, are those the images that are throughout? Are they
No,
Meredith?
so those are that was me playing with the, I think it's called Glitchy app, It's like an app on the phone that anybody can use, and I play with it far too much. So you can like take photographs and you can manipulate them. And when they do ask about, I mean, they're a really wonderful press. They ask about like the kind of cover that you would like and the kind of art. And so I could submit images to them. And I was like, well, I was playing with stuff. I knew that I wanted like a face or a body that was split into parts, like either two or three. And so I was like, how about something like this? And I gave them like a bunch of images in a Google Drive, but I also looked at like, you know, artists I found on Instagram, and I sent them those suggestions too. And then they came back with this cover, and I was like, oh, well, that's kind of fun. Like, so they're all my photos that I was messing around with and all the things that I sent them.
Are they
And then
all
they put them,
selfies?
yes.
Because they're hot, okay? They are sexy.
I
It's
know,
another
they're
reason for
ridiculous.
people to get this book.
But I was so excited when I saw it, when I got the
I love this one.
oh, thank you. Yeah, that's like my Hunter S. Thompson one.
Yes,
It's
yes.
very
I'm speaking of the image that's across from her. Terror is palpable for our readers who definitely have this book. I mean, listeners.
it's like to have full color on the inside. I was like really amazed that I
Yes.
was like, thank you. That said, that was a treat. Like I didn't expect that. That was their designer, like took the extra images that he wasn't using for the cover and it's like stuck them as the section dividers. And so I feel like a very lucky girl.
Hell yeah. And I feel like that's the kind of care you can get and collaboration you can get at a small press, where you don't
Yeah.
always get that in a larger house.
Right. There's so many voices in the larger house.
Yes. And they have their, the people they go to, and we just kind of go, thank you.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you. I'm a good girl. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I absolutely loved it. It's called The Familiar. It's on, I can't remember what exactly they changed their name to, but
Texas Review Press. You
Texas
Google
Review
that, you're
Press.
gonna find it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's there. It came out 2 days ago. You're on your tour, kind of.
Yeah. Kind of like in and out. I
In
kind
and
of did a
out.
launch at AWP and that was
Oh,
so much
cool.
fun. It was
Oh,
really good. Yeah.
that's always such a great, like, warm crowd, Like just
Yeah.
people nerding out about books and writers. It's the
Yeah.
best.
I know. I mean, it's got its issues. I understand. Like it costs a ton of money to get there
Yeah.
and to do the thing, and that sucks. But if you can't get in there, like it's just really, really it's yeah, for 4 to 5 days just to be like, bathing in the warmth of like writers that you admire and like just seeing all the work people put into their writing,
Yeah.
in the book fair. And it's yeah, I like it a lot.
That was our ad for AWP.
Yeah. I am not a paid
Nor
representative
I,
of
but
AWP.
we're open to negotiations, so just
Of
let us
course.
know.
I'll be your mascot.
Everybody go get The Familiar. Go to Sarah Kane Gutowski's website to see where she's going to be, if she's going to come near you. And yeah, thank you so much for coming on. This was a delight, as I knew it would be.
Thank you so much for having me on here. I can't tell you like this is, they tell you think about goals, like things that you would like to aspire to. And I was like, I want to be on I'm a Writer, but
Hell yes, I love that.
so
Check.
goal check.
Check. Yes.
Yeah.